Chapter 3. As first noted in Denial of Justice, Dorothy May Kilgallen was of Irish heritage, with her great-grandparents having settled in the Shraheen's Behola area of County Mayo, located a four-hour drive west of Dublin. An 1850s photograph, obtained by this author from Kilgallen's second cousins, depicts her great-grandfather, Andrew Kilgallen, alongside her great-grandmother, Mary Highland. She is donning what is known as a Mayo shawl. Born during a violent rainstorm on July 13, 1913, Dorothy was the second daughter to Jim and May Kilgallen. Jim was born to Andrew and Mary's son John, Dorothy's grandfather, and was one of 10 children. Jim, a tadpole of a man called Jimmy, or Kill, met May, a lovely redhead, while she was an aspiring singer in Denver. The couple chose the name Dorothy since it meant gift from heaven. They lived in a cheap rent apartment on Garfield Boulevard and Morgan Street in Chicago, where Jim was employed as a reporter. The family moved to Brooklyn when he was hired by the Hearst Syndicate. Dorothy Kilgallen attended school in a red brick building, P.S. 119, close to her home. Despite her father's prodding, Dorothy's grades were only a bit above average. The Catholic family regularly attended nearby St. Elizabeth's Catholic Church and St. Thomas Aquinas Church. Besides an interest in acting, she had appeared in a stage play at an early age, Kilgallen read book after book borrowed from a nearby library. A favorite was the Elsie Dinsmore series, written by Martha Finley between 1867 and 1905. The books tell the story of the life and spiritual commitment of Elsie Dinsmore, a charming young heroine whose Christian faith and hope guide her as she grows from childhood to adulthood in the Civil War South. Kilgallen later told an interviewer she admired Finley's dramatic writing style, one she apparently decided to emulate. To be certain, Kilgallen had a streak of shyness, but as she grew older, a lively personality shone through when mingling with friends. She especially enjoyed school dances and parties. Boys were attracted to her, but her feelings were hurt when she learned a friend called her stuck up and made fun of her hairstyle. A description at the time noted Kilgallen was of medium height and skinny like her father, parted her dark hair in the middle, and had thin lips. When her mother caught her wearing lipstick at too early an age, Kilgallen was grounded. When friends made fun of her, Kilgallen told them, "I'll show you. Someday I'll be very famous and all of you will read about me." Lacking confidence was certainly never a Kilgallen trademark. The young girl did not keep a diary, but she wrote several poems, short stories, and letters to friends she had known in Chicago. One short story chronicled a family visit to the Empire State Building. She wrote, "I could see the whole world from the top all the way to California." By all accounts, Kilgallen's first published work was a letter to the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle. Her father was quite proud when it was published, amazed that the editor thought it was written by an adult, an indication that Kilgallen had talent as a wordsmith, a talent passed on by her father. She signed the letter Dorothy Lorington, apparently to establish her own identity, a sign of the independent streak that would filter into her personality in later years. Kilgallen's imagination ran wild at times. One day she skipped school to see a favorite movie. When she returned home, Jim asked her what happened at school that day. Ruffled, Kilgallen said she didn't go since a friend had chickenpox and she had to get some medicine for her at a pharmacy. Unfortunately, a neighbor told Jim she had seen Kilgallen at the movies. Kilgallen was grounded again. During her tenure as an associate editor of The Erasmian, her high school's literary magazine, Kilgallen tried her hand at fiction by publishing the story of an English aviator and his romance with an Italian peasant girl. Short stories became her friend, and she wrote many of them after finishing her homework. Bernard Malamud, who would later win both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, submitted a novel to Kilgallen. Her review stated that the story was too depressing. Regarding her appearance at the time, he recalled Kilgallen as a unique, animated, immaculately dressed woman without a chin, very careful about her physical appearance. Though visibly adorned with rouge and lipstick, it was well applied. She had a sense of her own importance. That would serve her well in the adventurous days ahead. Jim Kilgallen and his daughter had some light-hearted times. He later claimed, "My typewriter was at a window in the front, and I used to sit my daughter Dorothy, who was 1 year old, up there and let her bang on the keys." Whenever possible, Kilgallen visited her dad's Evening Journal office in New York City. Wide-eyed, she listened to the reporters talk about the various stories they were covering, soaking up the buzz of the newsroom. In a 1960 New York Post article about Kilgallen, Jim was quoted as saying, "I'd come home at night from work, Journal American, and the wife and two kids and the mother-in-law would sit around and I'd tell them how great I was. In those days I was being sent all over the country. I'd think nothing of being told to shoot down to Miami to interview John D. Rockefeller Sr. The family was big-eyed when I'd talk about the greats or the trials I was covering, and the one with the biggest eyes was always Dorothy. She said many a time, 'I want to be just like you.'" A Post reporter added, "Dorothy burned with impatient yearnings. She devoured romantic novels, wept at sad movies, and at 12 took in hand and wrote an indignant letter to the Brooklyn Eagle newspaper protesting a critical slur of Ramon Navarro, a movie star she worshipped." Like Marilyn, Kilgallen was feisty, never hesitant to speak her mind even before attaining the proper status. Curious as to what drove her father to become so prominent, leading to accolades for his reporting skills, Dorothy asked, "Dad, what is the most important aspect of being a journalist?" Without hesitation, Jim replied, "Telling the truth." Kilgallen never forgot those words, ones that would become the foundation of everything she wrote in the coming years, and ultimately lead to her baffling death many years later. To please her mother, 1 year after the family withstood the horrors of the stock market crash in 1929, Kilgallen reluctantly entered the College of New Rochelle, located 25 miles from Brooklyn. Later, in a magazine interview for TV Radio Mirror, Kilgallen admitted that her first year there was enjoyable, pleasing. A classmate named George Kittinen said later that she had fine and Irish skin, very large blue eyes, and that her figure was well-developed. Compliments contrary to descriptions of her during her earlier years. Kilgallen appreciated Kittinen's words of praise, but felt what he said was sexist, symbolic of similar remarks she later disdained when fame came her way. For months on end in 1931, Kilgallen, age 18, had been begging her father to speak with Amateur Spiro, the Evening Journal's city editor, to see if he, as a favor to Jim, might give her a shot at becoming a reporter during a 2-week trial period. Spiro acquiesced, and the favor permitted Kilgallen the chance she needed. Without question, Dorothy Kilgallen earned her right to be called a top reporter in later years. To the disappointment of her mother, who believed that she'd end up hanging out at bars and drinking with fellow reporters, she dropped out of college to follow in the footsteps of her father, whose outstanding career included covering the Black Sox baseball scandal, Charles A. Lindbergh's historic flight to Paris, the Morrow Castle ship fire off the New Jersey coast, the Alger Hiss case, and the surrender of Nazi Germany in World War II. William Randolph Hearst Jr. said of Jim, "I am sure no journalist in history was more devoted to his profession." In fact, when Hearst picked the New York Journal American's 10 Most Memorable Men and Women Reporters for his book The Hearsts, Father and Son, at the top of the list were Jimmy and his daughter Dorothy. His reasoning? Jimmy, because he saw and covered so much of America and the world. Dorothy, because much of her career and her life and death were so dramatic. After gaining some experience writing social items and covering exciting criminal trials, Dorothy Kilgallen joined a long list of respected contributors to the newspaper. They had included, during the years before she worked for the paper, such luminaries as Emile Zola on literature, George Bernard Shaw on socio-political trends, and Susan B. Anthony and Helen Keller on women's issues. In one of her first stories that indicated a soft heart for those less fortunate, she wrote a 1931 account that marked the first time, as she later said, a bylined piece and the story that assured her future on the paper. It began, "With a sweet, patient smile lighting his baby eyes, 4-year-old little angel face of Bellevue continued to fight bravely today against the ravages of infantile paralysis that is slowly overcoming him after more than 72 hours in an artificial respirator. His tiny, emaciated body has been encased in this scientific lung since 2 p.m. Saturday, while doctors and nurses try by every method known to science to ease the suffering and preserve the life of this little child of the tenements whom they have grown to love for his endearing sweetness." Meanwhile, despite William Randolph Hearst's friendship and support of Adolf Hitler, Kilgallen kept politics out of her reporting while gaining a reputation as a hard-nosed journalist who printed the truth. When she did throw in a column with political flavor, it usually indicated her preference for the conservative end of things, the Republican side, leading to her being called, at one point, a violently right-wing columnist by the New York Daily News. Kilgallen's friends included stars from stage and screen like Marilyn, as well as famous musicians. Hearst wrote, "Dorothy became a celebrity at the Stork Club, the Copa, and a dozen other joints that dazzled with rich debutantes, models, actors, wealthy playboys, and other society swingers like Dorothy." He added, "Before she died, she was dating and dancing with everyone from big-name authors to lounge lizards who were hanging on for the ride. Dorothy was a comet, and her trail of sparks lit up the sky. If both of us had a few minutes, we would have a drink and talk newspapering. She was enthusiastic, open, full of life." Kilgallen covered serious topics in her column, but she could be lighthearted as well. One excerpt read, "The whole town is talking. Excitement abounds. For a glorious story is going the rounds. The buzz is on Broadway from dawn until dark. There's glorious clamor in Gramercy Park. It's sweeping through Broome Street. It's waltzing in Wall," an obvious reference to Wall Street. How proud her father must have been when the Evening Journal editors decided to post a 3/4-page promotional ad touting her reporting. To read one of Dorothy Kilgallen's brilliantly written stories, it might be an interview with a famous politician or a gangster, it might be the current day-to-day reporting of a famous murder trial, one would immediately infer, here is the writing of a veteran newspaper woman with a lifetime of experience in reporting. But a glance at the picture above will show how far from the facts such an impression can be. For Dorothy Kilgallen is only 20 years old. She is a modern, up-to-the-minute woman reporter. With her versatile, sparkling writing and her far-beyond-her-years perception and power of observation, she can cover everything from a baby shower to a sensational police court trial. When Dorothy Kilgallen covered the Jack Ruby trial in 1964, where he was charged with killing alleged JFK assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, it was the second so-called trial of the century she reported on. The first had been in 1935, when she beat out several fellow Evening Journal reporters to attend the trial of German-born Bruno Hauptmann. He was charged with kidnapping and killing famed aviator Charles Lindbergh's 20-month-old son, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. When the guilty verdict was announced, Kilgallen, who had spoken to Hauptmann until his lawyers told him not to do so, was not surprised, writing, "The evidence is overwhelming toward guilt." Like the other journalists, she did not shed a tear when the German was executed. In October 1936, Kilgallen, then 23, entered the famous Girl Around the World competition. It should be recalled that in 1924, When she was only 11, there was not a single commercial aircraft operating within the United States. And it was only 12 years later that the dirigible Hindenburg was the first to provide regular transportation between the United States and Germany, since such travel was still considered quite risky. The trigger point for interest in the race appears to be when the China Clipper announced it could carry passengers from Manila to San Francisco. A Scripps Howard reporter named Bud Eakin, described as a scrappy, hard-working, shrewd, and competitive reporter, decided to see if he could circle the globe in such an aircraft, and when this became known, Leo Kieran, a slender, blue-eyed, fair-haired reporter for the New York Times, announced he would try the same. Word reached Kilgallen's newspaper offices, and a decision was made to enter a reporter in the race. At the time, the young journalist had never been outside the United States and had only flown once for a short time. She apparently was not schooled in the ways of geography, since a teacher had written "not proficient" on her report card next to that subject. When the young woman told her mother that she might be selected for the race, May was dubious, but her father, Jim, was encouraging, telling his daughter, "It's a hell of an assignment." Armed with her father's confidence, Kilgallen's decision was finalized when she received a telegram from famed aviator Amelia Earhart, the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean and the first person ever to fly solo from Hawaii to the United States mainland. As noted in the epilogue, the two courageous women's life and times and their deaths intersect, as they truly were kindred spirits. Tragically, during a flight to circumnavigate the globe in July 1937, a year after Kilgallen's race, Earhart's Lockheed Electroplane, akin to her flying laboratory at Purdue University where she was an inspiring women's career counselor as of 1935, disappeared somewhere over the Pacific. The plane wreckage was never found, and she was officially declared lost at sea, with the cause of her disappearance and death a mystery to this day. The telegram to Kilgallen read, "I know you can make it, Dorothy, but you must follow your normal schedule of eating, drinking, and sleeping, even though on such a trip. Forget you are flying, and you won't even get air-weary. Imagine you are back at the evening journal offices and stick to one brand of bottled water throughout." Restricted to using only commercial aircraft to circle the globe, Kilgallen finished second but gained the respect of women everywhere, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. On White House stationery dated October 26, 1936, the First Lady wrote in her own hand, "I have been so interested in your flight around the world with the men, and even though I am sure you are disappointed in not being the first to arrive, I wanted to tell you that I was rather pleased to have a woman go. It took a good deal of pluck, and it must have held a good many thrills. With congratulations and good wishes, I am, very sincerely yours, Eleanor Roosevelt." Now Kilgallen was famous at last, just as promised early on, with several newspapers lauding her willingness to carry the banner for women's rights by challenging the two men. The episode was a prelude to Kilgallen becoming a true advocate for her gender, though she may have never realized the accomplishment at the time. Soon after, Kilgallen wrote Girl Around the World, chronicling the amazing adventure. It was her first published book. One edition featured a light blue cover with black lettering and an image in Kilgallen's likeness carrying a typewriter case and a hatbox. In the book's foreword, a tribute from Dorothy's father, Jim wrote, "I am proud of you. Not because you were a good newspaper woman at 18, not because you have become famous at 23 by flying around the world. I am proud of you because now that your greatest journalistic achievement is over and the plaudits have died down, you are the same unspoiled girl you have always been. Today your future looms bright. I believe your success is assured. You have given me the thrill of a lifetime, and you have proved you had what Damon Runyon termed moxie, courage." Kilgallen, who later wore a pith helmet accessorized with open-toed opera pumps in the India desert, rode in the Hindenburg during the trip and tells of her account on it in the book, where there is a photo of the shadow of the dirigible over the sea, which trumpeted her willingness to take chances. She wrote, "I'm off on a race around the world, a race against time and two men. I know I can beat time. I hope to beat the men." Kilgallen, who had promised her father she'd attend Catholic Mass whenever possible, also included words that would define her career until she died 29 years later. "I'm a reporter who likes danger and excitement," she added. "This assignment has been much easier than covering murder trials and much prettier, while admitting to being a bit scared in Calcutta when a lizard crawled in bed with me, but enthused when the guys learned I could shoot dice." In addition to her feat of crossing the Pacific, the fearless Kilgallen set a record for the fastest 5,000-mile span ever flown, Hawaii to New York City. Providing her readers with a visual sense of the adventure, she wrote, "Dawn found us sailing serenely northward, over French Indochinese jungles where tigers and great constrictor snakes lie in wait for little girls. Bump, bump, splash. We thumped down in the middle of a rice field, appearing like gnomes from the ground. About 600 chattering natives, nearly naked, surrounded the plain. They spoke no English, of course, and we could not understand Siamese." Perhaps the book's most moving passage is Kilgallen's account of her conversation with a French-speaking police commissioner in Hanoi, French Indochina, today's Vietnam. "Are you English?" he asked me, using that tongue brokenly. When I told him I was American, he answered flatteringly, "Of course. What else could you be with such courage?" When she returned to Brooklyn, every house on her block was decorated with American flags and her photograph, and greeting Dorothy was her cat, Cotton, and her dog, Mitzi. The book Girl Around the World became the loosely based movie Fly Away Baby in 1937. The crime mystery film featured Glenda Farrell as crime reporter Torchy Blaine, who, along with her detective boyfriend, solves a murder and smuggling case during a round-the-world flight. This was the second film in the Torchy Blaine series released by Warner Brothers. Kilgallen had a small part in the film. As she hit the age of 24, the Chicago-born little girl who was interested in reporting was now a household name. Louis Sobel, a fellow reporter on the Evening Journal, wrote of Kilgallen's world at the time, "This slender, wide-eyed, deceivingly naive in attitude and soft-spoken mannerisms female reporter was to herself mingling with a new set of characters, racket guys, grafters, phonies, creep janes, society fops, chorus girls, pimps, overdressed Jezebels and their rent payers." During this time, a budding romance swirled about the new celebrity. It came when she had a crush on one of the biggest names in show business, actor Tyrone Power. He had starred in the film Lloyds of London, and Kilgallen became smitten, noting in a column called As Seen from Hollywood by Dorothy Kilgallen, "Now there is a dream man." How they met is a bit of a mystery, but it appears it was during a publicity event for his hit film. Soon, the twosome, the same age, were dining at the best Hollywood eateries, hitting the nightclubs and enjoying each other's company. She liked his pork pie hat and camel's hair coat. When they visited the Santa Anita racetrack, she wore a cherry red hat that he had bought for her. The happy couple made a deal. Kilgallen would teach him about choosing horses, as if she knew anything about that, and he would teach her how to drive, a dismal failure. A fast friendship had developed, but she mistook friendship for a romantic interest on his part. But he was actually in love with Sonja Henie, a Norwegian Olympian figure skater and film star. It was no matter to Kilgallen. She continued to pursue the handsome Power as Mr. Perfect, to the point that when she wrote a short story for Cosmopolitan entitled Holiday from Hollywood, he was the model for the featured star. Unfortunately, the happy ending in a work of fiction did not duplicate real life, as Kilgallen's friendship with the famous actor outlived any romantic potential. Regardless, enjoying her new celebrity, Kilgallen continued in Hollywood to collect inside details about film and television for her Evening Journal gossip column. In a prelude to her ever-widening media exposure, she appeared in the movie Sinner Take All. It starred Bruce Cabot and Margaret Lindsay, and featured a former newspaper reporter turned lawyer who represented a family whose members kept getting bumped off. He used his investigative background and the newspaper's resources, including Kilgallen's reporter character, to dig into the family's history. Doing so led to exposing the murderer. When the film was released, her five lines had been reduced to one, a jab she did not take lightly. Apparently, Kilgallen's acting ability was still impressive enough that she screen-tested for a film role in The Reporter. When no offer came her way, she sulked over the rejection. However, a smile covered her face when Louis Sobel, commenting on Kilgallen's appearance at a Broadway theater opening, wrote, "Out of a streamlined, shiny chariot stepped a fragile, raven-haired honey, a thinnish youth with bat ears and pop eyes, and a 10th Avenue sub-deb fought each other to be at her side. 'Will you sign this, Miss Kilgallen?' pleaded the boy, thrusting out his soiled autograph album." Sobel added, "She still goes to church on Sundays, blushes when profanity is set loose within her hearing, and walks away from obscene stories." Sobel's praise must have meant a great deal to Kilgallen, since he was a well-known journalist himself, best known for his column New York Cavalcade, which spiced up the Broadway scene similar to Kilgallen's chronicle of show business in the Voice of Broadway column. Tongue-in-cheek, Sobel once wrote of his column, "I indulge in no profound crusading calisthenics. No world problems are attacked or solved here. We run along in our little corner, offering no more excitement than a muffled pop gun." During the Christmas holidays in 1937, when Kilgallen turned 24, a surprise announcement appeared in Hearst newspapers across the country. The first and only woman columnist, Dorothy Kilgallen's Voice of Broadway column starts Monday. A man's job. Beginning Monday in the New York Journal American, Dorothy Kilgallen will report daily on the deeds and misdeeds of Broadway. A man's job. But Dorothy has been doing a man's job and doing it better. Author's note, the New York Evening Journal and the New York American merged into the New York Journal American in 1937. This accolade should not be taken lightly. Nearly all of the top columnists at the time were men, and rising to their level was a major obstacle due to the gender discrimination of the day. Then, women, many males believed, weren't even supposed to sit in the back seat of a car. They were supposed to sit in the car behind. Regardless, the Voice of Broadway was created to deal with theater, politics, crime, and the news and gossip of the day. Kilgallen's main competition included Walter Winchell, Ed Sullivan, Lucius Beebe, and Leonard Lyons. Each slammed Marilyn through the years, criticizing her whenever they had a chance. At its height of popularity, Kilgallen's column was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country. As the star columnist of her era, she had the best sources and the power to make or break a career. She was feared, not because, like Marilyn, she was beautiful and sexy, but because she was a woman of integrity, one who always sought the truth. In late summer 1939, there was a mention in Kilgallen's column that Richard Colmer, Knickerbocker Holiday, Broadway show baritone, gave a combination New Year's Eve and birthday party Saturday night to which guests were asked to come in kiddie costumes. This led to one of the most important events in her life, her marriage to Richard Colmer in April 1940. Over time, three children were born, Richard Jr., Jill, and Kerry. Without question, Kilgallen was a jazz enthusiast. In 1940, under the banner Broadway Columnist Names Her All-Time Swing Band, appearing in Cosmopolitan magazine, she included Benny Goodman, Bix Biederbeck, and Bessie Smith, of whom Kilgallen wrote in gifted prose, "Bessie sang with the voice of centuries of tragedy, She moaned low, and she wailed out lyrics that were strange, simple, and primitive, and she made them sound as real as the sound of a heart breaking. On November 8, 1953, she debuted a column, one that featured from time to time items on jazz staples Laverne Baker or Mabel Mercer, entitled Let's Play Post Office. She answered readers' letters, including one where Kilgallen provided advice about how to avoid being a square when at a jazz club, and another to a reader who was soliciting advice on jazz hipster lingo. She wrote, "You see, nobody's digging your clothes, Daddy-O. They're too busy quaffing the groove juice and flipping over that crazy gone jib because it's the most."